I'm happy now to welcome back to the program Fred Nathan. He is founder and executive director of Think New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me back, Mary Charlotte.
So the legislative session is just getting started, as pretty much everybody knows by now, and you do a lot of legislative work on a state level here in New Mexico. That's what Think New Mexico is all about?
Correct. We're a little bit different than most think tanks. We have an advocacy component, so we're not just content with producing white papers and crossing our collective fingers and hoping something good happens. We like to get after it, and we've got an office here in Santa Fe across the street from the Capitol. And
right.
So we come up with proposals. We like to see them through to completion.
And so proposals concern things like reform of the PRC, Public Regulation Commission, and this must have been a good year for you.
We had a very good year,
last year
with our PRC proposals, which we were able to get on the ballot with the help of a lot of your listeners, actually. And we were delighted in November that all three passed. The one on increasing the qualifications for PRC commissioners, we were really heartened that that passed with more than 535,000 votes, which is the most ever for a constitutional amendment in New Mexico, which we feel gives us a popular mandate to go back to the legislature and specify what those higher qualifications should be.
Well, this is something that's very interesting. I mean, you vote for a constitutional amendment saying we want to have qualified people being on the Public Regulation Commission because it is very important and it affects all our lives, but the details of that aren't even written yet?
That's correct, because constitutional amendments, we want to keep the Constitution as a short, concise document. So basically all that amendment did was to advocate for higher qualifications and authorize the legislature to pass higher qualifications in statute. And that's why we're so pleased by that vote, because there's a question as to what those qualifications should be. And we'll be able to say, well, more than 80% of New Mexicans voted for this, so it's some indication that they want those qualifications set at a high level.
And so there is a bill that's going to go through the legislature and be voted on. What does the bill look like, more or less?
Well, that bill would basically, what we're trying to do is increase the qualifications, but not bar people that could do a good job of serving. So that's, by the way, House Bill 47, for those of you who are following at home.
Okay.
And what it would do is, we looked at it the same way that a private employer would look at it, hiring someone. You want to see some educational qualifications, and you want to see professional qualifications, and we're just trying to create some pathways to that that bear on people's relevant experiences. So one way to get to be qualified to run for the PRC would be to have a bachelor's or higher degree in a relevant field, such as accounting, business administration, sciences, economics, energy, engineering, environmental sciences, those kinds of relevant fields. And I always like to joke, you know, my wife has a master's in fine art from Yale, and she's a graphic designer, and I love her dearly, but I wouldn't want her, and I wouldn't think she'd actually be qualified to set our utility bills or our utility rates, even though she is highly educated.
But so then you have another part of the bill says that if you don't have a bachelor's degree in one of those fields, but you have 7 years of work experience in one of those fields, that still qualifies.
That still qualifies you, as long as it's a relevant field again. Things like accounting and engineering and economics and all the various fields that the PRC commissioners deal with. So what we're trying to do is be both inclusive while trying to raise that bar.
Excellent. So are there any other bills that affect the PRC that are being considered this year?
Yes, there's two others that implement or enable the constitutional amendments to go into effect. The other one that I think will be of great interest to your listeners, Mary Charlotte, is the one about taking the Department of Insurance out of the PRC. And the voters did that again in November, and we thought that that was a very good thing in and of itself, to remove the Department of Insurance, where it's never really been a good fit. And that department's been on probation by its national accrediting unit, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, three times in its 16 years under the PRC.
Oh, goodness.
So, and always for the same thing, which is that they weren't hiring qualified people to do those jobs. So jobs that should have been reserved for accountants and actuaries and lawyers were sometimes going to
graphic designers
and political friends of former PRC commissioners. So just by getting it out of there, I think it'll be addition by subtraction. But
then, where will it go?
Well, that's a great question, and that's what this legislation will decide. Actually, there's two things. Where will it go, and who will select the superintendent of insurance, which of course is a very important position.
Right.
So let's take your question first. The choices really are whether it could be a standalone agency or whether it should be under a cabinet secretary. And our overriding goal with this bill is to insulate the Department of Insurance from politics. So after talking to lots of stakeholders, we thought the better course was to make it a standalone agency like the Workers' Comp Administration, but with lots of checks and balances. So, for example, obviously the legislature will set the budget. They'll also set the salary of the superintendent. If there's malfeasance by the superintendent, the governor could petition the Supreme Court to hold a hearing and impeach the superintendent of insurance. So there's lots of checks. Also, the department would have to make an annual report for accountability purposes to the legislature, which is always a good thing. So there are lots of checks and balances, but we came down on the side of making it a standalone agency. And then the next question is, how do you select the superintendent of insurance? And there we came up, I think, with a novel approach, which has worked before in New Mexico. Several years ago, they went through five superintendents in a four-month period. And at the end of that, when they picked the fifth superintendent, the PRC decided to appoint a committee, and every PRC member picked two people. I was fortunate to be one of the persons that served on that committee. And it was a very diverse committee with Democrats, Republicans, Independents, rural, urban, consumer advocates, insurance industry types, and everybody thought it was going to be a Donnybrook. But we were all looking for the same thing. We wanted the most qualified.
They thought it was going to be a what?
A Donnybrook, just a wild fight. And we actually were able to figure it out by consensus, even though we had some very different viewpoints. And that was the process that led to John Franchini, who I think has been a very good superintendent of insurance. So what we did in statute, or what we're trying to pass in statute, is a bill that would have the legislature pick four members of a committee. The governor would pick four members of this committee.
And they have to be from different political parties in a very balanced way.
That's a very important thing that you point out, that no, either the governor, well, both the governor and the legislature can't pick any more than two members of one party. So it's going to be fairly split. And then those eight members would pick the chairman, who has to be either a former superintendent of insurance or someone with extensive knowledge. So, and then they would pick the superintendent of insurance. And so based on that prior experience, we're confident this will be a good process to pick sort of a non-political superintendent of insurance who's highly qualified.
I was reading through that bill, and on the one hand, it's like, okay, it's sort of bureaucratic. But when you look at it structurally, and what is created by that, it makes you really contemplate how the structure of an organization really influences the culture of that organization, because it has these checks and balances to prevent it being really one-sided. It has these checks and balances to prevent it being pure political appointees who don't really know what they're doing. And suddenly you actually have a culture that is about getting the job done.
Right, and that's very perceptive. And by the way, this is House Bill 45 for your listeners following at home.
Yes.
And that's exactly the culture we're trying to change the culture, and we think this sort of nonpartisan approach will lead to a much less political department that's just focused on regulating insurance in a non-biased way.
We're talking to Fred Nathan of Think New Mexico. So is that it for the PRC, or is there one more?
There's one more, which is House Bill 46. So these are House Bills 45, 46, and 47. And this one implements the a corporate reporting unit being moved from the PRC to the Secretary of State's office, which already regulates other corporations.
So, okay.
So this creates sort of a one-stop shop. And regulating is, it probably overstates what they do. Really what they're doing is accepting paperwork from LLCs and limited liability partnerships and not-for-profits just to make sure that the state knows who's on the board and who's their agent of service of process. And 41 states do it this way, where they have a one-stop shop at the Secretary of State's office. And this bill is really designed to implement that and make it a more efficient process.
So currently, if you are a sole proprietor of a pedicure shop in the mall, you have to go to the PRC to file your paperwork.
Right.
And now you would go to the Secretary of State's office and do everything in one place?
That's exactly right. And so it makes it easier for the public. And this is a very long bill, but really all it's doing is crossing out everywhere in statute where it says the corporate reporting unit is at the PRC and just moving it to the Secretary of State's office.
Now, is this all about just is this particular one all about just efficiency, or are there other motives to putting it in the Secretary of State's office?
Well, it's about efficiency, and I would say it's also about competence, frankly. The corporate reporting unit has historically been plagued by lots of delays. This is a very ministerial task that should take about 5 minutes. You hand in your paperwork. They look to see that you've filled it out correctly, you pay your fee, and you're on your way. But in too many cases, it's been taking weeks and months. There have been lost checks. The Albuquerque Journal, you know, documented this in a story they did several months ago. So I would say it's both about efficiency as well as competency. The unit in the Secretary of State's office has worked well for a very long time, so we're hoping that, again, we can change the culture and make it a much more efficient and competent unit and better serve the public.
Who writes laws and regulations? Are there any rules about that?
Well, laws are written by the Legislative Council Service, and we always, I have a wonderful colleague named Christina Fisher, who I'm going to brag about now, who graduated first in her class at UNM Law School, so we take advantage of her talents and skills, and so she always drafts the first draft, and then we get it polished with the Legislative Council Service. And regulations are generally drafted by the general counsels at the various agencies.
And what is, if any, is public or citizen input?
Well, they should have hearings for both statutes and regulations, and fortunately in New Mexico we do. And so there's a big opportunity for the public to get involved, and we always encourage people to come and testify to the legislature, so it's not just the professional lobbying class that's telling our elected officials what to do, but we want them to be acquainted with their constituents. And a great way to do that, if I can plug our website, is to go to the Action Center at Think New Mexico's website, www.thinknewmexico.org. And there's a very easy way. In fact, we have pre-scripted letters, which we encourage people to edit and put in their own original comments and send to their legislators. And the wonderful thing is you don't need to know who your legislators are. Just by typing in your address, our computer will make sure that they get to your specific legislators and the governor and the lieutenant governor.
So in your view, having worked on the issue of the PRC for a long time, we're headed in the right direction?
Yeah, I'm convinced that we are. The two big problems that really needed to be addressed was the fact that PRC commissioners under the old law weren't always qualified. The qualifications were set so low. You only had to be 18 years of age, lived in the state at least 1 year, and not be a convicted felon. The other big problem is that they were the most powerful state regulatory agency in the country because they had so much on their plate. And that's always a bad combination, to have enormous power with very few qualifications.
Yeah.
And by removing the Department of Insurance, which, you know, a lot of commissioners have told us in and of itself is a full-time job, like Doug Howe and Jason Marks, two former commissioners, supported this legislation to remove the Department of Insurance and to remove the corporate reporting unit, because they just felt that there's just too much power consolidated in one place. And that's fairly atypical. I've been around the legislature for 2 decades now, and I can remember many cases of elected officials asking for more power, but this is the only case where elected officials actually testified that they had too much power and the public would be better served if some of that power was distributed to other parts of state government.
That is very interesting.
Yeah, and unusual.
Yeah. We're talking to Fred Nathan of Think New Mexico. What else, what other bills are you supporting this year?
So we have a fourth PRC bill that hasn't been introduced yet, so I don't have a bill number. And it has to do with reforming the New Mexico Motor Carriers Act, which is another thing that the PRC regulates. And just to give your listeners a 30-second synopsis of motor vehicle regulation in New Mexico,
yes,
and statehood, people were very worried about the railroads. And that's why we had the old State Corporation Commission, which was to regulate corporations and specifically the very powerful railroads that were corrupting state governments all across the country. And then in the 1930s, the railroads came to the State Corporation Commission and said, you know, you're heavily regulating us, but there's this new industry called trucking, and they're not regulated at all. And so the State Corporation started to regulate motor carriers, buses, limousines, taxis, moving lines, and so forth.
And that doesn't include delivery. That's a different thing.
No, there's interstate, which is regulated by the feds, and intrastate within the state is regulated by the state.
Right.
And then in 1980, you're anticipating where I'm going with this, President Carter and Ted Kennedy passed a bill to deregulate the airlines and the trucking industry for interstate commerce. And that was very successful both from a consumer standpoint and from an industry standpoint. And at the time, they said to the states, you know, you're free to continue to regulate intrastate. And many states said, no, we want to follow the federal lead. But
so intrastate means within your state. Interstate is between states.
Exactly right. And so New Mexico continued to do this regulation. So fast forward to 2012, and the PRC continues to enforce a 1930s-era law where they make decisions about market entry. So, for example, if you have a taxi cab or you want to start a taxi cab company, and in Santa Fe we have just one, you can't just start the business. You have to get the PRC's permission. And they look at it from the standpoint of the incumbent companies. And what we're trying to do is say, why don't we look at it from the standpoint of the community, whether the community would be better served by an additional taxi cab company. So we're trying to sort of rationalize the regulation there, as well as with price setting. So if you get permission to start your taxi cab company in Santa Fe, it would be the PRC that would set the prices, not the business itself. And again, we think that might be better left to the market with maybe a lighter regulatory hand. And in fact, there was this case in Santa Fe several years ago where a green entrepreneur wanted to start a taxi cab company in Santa Fe, which has only one company. And his idea was to have a taxi cab company with just hybrid vehicles, which could have been, I think, very appealing. And
I've seen those in Los Angeles, these yellow Prius taxis.
Right, and it would be, I think, extremely popular here. And what happened was he filed the paperwork. He ended up hiring a lawyer to help him and spent $25,000 to $50,000. And under this very antiquated law, he had to notify his competitor, who immediately filed a 200-page legal brief, not including affidavits, and wanted to take his deposition. And at that point, the entrepreneur threw in the towel. And So
basically, you can't, if you want to start a taxi service in the state of New Mexico, you have to notify the existing taxi cab services, and they can basically say no, sorry?
They can oppose you, and then there's a hearing at the PRC. And, you know, today we did a study of the 33 counties in New Mexico for taxi cab service. 24 of those counties either have no taxi cab service or just a single monopoly.
Yeah.
And we think it's partly because of these stiff barriers to entry that really are antithetical to consumer protection and so forth. So,
and there are some interesting provisions in the bill that you're proposing, which would basically still ensure a kind of fairness in the market among the different people. So if somebody, well, you tell us.
Well, you're exactly right, and you've obviously done your homework on this. So this isn't deregulation. It's really rationalizing fair regulation. And so, for example, in Albuquerque, there would be sort of two types of taxicab companies. There are full service that do 24/7 work, and some of that isn't always profitable. And then there's another kind of taxicab service where you just take people from the hotels in downtown Albuquerque to the airport, which is very lucrative. And so there really is a role to play in terms of regulating that, because you wouldn't want a lot of companies coming in and skimming off the lucrative business and then making it difficult for somebody to provide 24 service
exactly
to the little, you know, little lady who just wants to go around the corner, can't drive to the grocery store, which isn't particularly profitable.
So there's protections for people who provide services that are really essentially, even though it's a for-profit business, they're essentially community services, and there's protection in this bill for that.
That's exactly right.
You guys are so smart.
Well, we've gotten a lot of input from a lot of different people, and usually the simplistic results, and I know there'll probably be a bill in that just says, well, why don't we just deregulate the whole thing? That would be a mistake. I think there's actually going to be a bill in from the industry people also saying, you know, let's pretty much keep it status quo and do a couple of tweaks here and there. So we're probably in this debate going to be positioned right in the middle.
Right in the middle. Very interesting. And this is the other thing that your work in reading these bills shows me is that whole cliche, it's the devil's in the details. It's the details of bills like this that if good laws and regulations are passed, the public really doesn't know in general what they say, but their lives are better because of them.
Right, and they do know when there are unintended consequences and you don't do your homework, and that's why Christina's been burning the midnight oil, is to make sure that there won't be any of those unfortunate unintended consequences. And over the years, I think we've been pretty good in terms of our bills not having too many of those.
So another thing that you've worked on in the past, and I don't think there's anything in this legislative session coming up on that, but is small school size.
Well, actually, we're going to bring that bill back.
Oh,
so
are you?
Yeah, it hasn't been introduced yet, so I don't have a bill number. But you're exactly right. We, you know, if there's about four decades of research now indicating that smaller schools are generally more effective in creating graduates, and that they have higher rates of student achievement and higher satisfaction rates among students, parents, teachers, and principals. But, of course, it cuts against the grain. That's why it's great to be on this show, of the prevailing conventional wisdom, which is that schools, and in fact, historically, they've been modeled after factories.
Yeah, economies of scale.
Yeah, that's been the issue. And if kids were widgets, that would be the right approach, and we should build very, very big schools. But what we found with our very, very big schools patterned after factories is that children are not widgets, and they're very alienated in those settings. And that harms, you know, their education.
Well, and I also, I mean, we've talked about this in other contexts, but in big schools, a lot of the time, they start to make them into, like, minimum security prisons, and you've got metal detectors and things like that, which isn't really very efficient, because you're having to add a gigantic and costly security infrastructure.
You're absolutely right, Mary Charlotte. In Albuquerque, APS, the Albuquerque Public Schools, spends $5.1 million of recurring revenue each year policing their schools. And if you look at which schools they're policing, it's these very, very large high schools. And it would be more cost effective to simply build smaller schools and disband the police force,
right,
that has to police those schools. And it's interesting, after that terrible tragedy in Columbine, Colorado, the Department of Education did a very interesting study where they looked at all public schools by size. And what they found was that as schools get larger, you have more violent incidents per capita. And it just, I think, demonstrates that these larger schools, because there's more anonymity and more alienation, there's also more violence that comes with that. And so that would be a way, you know, that's a very big issue now with what happened in
Newtown.
But one way to better teach our children and also to reduce the violence is to make them more like communities.
Yeah.
And so that no kid falls through the cracks. And I don't know the details about the person that killed all those children in Newtown, but I think he was a student at that school, and maybe he fell between the cracks.
We're talking to Fred Nathan. So think New Mexico. In the past, your many campaigns have a very excellent success rate.
With the help of a lot of friends and supporters, some of your listeners, and you as well, Mary Charlotte, for always giving us a bully pulpit.
Well, it's good to, I mean, it's actually really good to, it's called Think New Mexico. You guys do your thinking and you help us think about what kinds of laws would really actually help the people of New Mexico. And another thing that you have been involved with, I mean, and really from a public service point of view, what would be best for the people of the state? And another thing is all the anti-corruption stuff and political contributions and things like that, which, of course, that's the belly of the beast.
That is the belly of the beast. And we've got a bill as well in that area. This is, I think, our most ambitious session. That bill hasn't been introduced yet. But Jacob Candelaria, who's actually a former Think New Mexico intern who just got elected this year and is a state senator from the west side of Albuquerque, also, by the, interestingly, our first, actually our second openly gay state senator, Liz Stefanik, of course, I think was the first, is carrying a bill that we have to ban political contributions by government contractors. You know, who obviously have a conflict of interest,
right.
And that's led to some problems in the past. And this is a bill patterned actually after the Hatch Act, which is named for Carl Hatch, who was a United States senator from New Mexico, who passed that in somewhere in the 1940s. I forget which year exactly. But that's been on the books for about seven decades. And we'd like to do the same thing back here in New Mexico, where government contractors who get these very lucrative contracts, sometimes, you know, a few days after making a contribution, and that really destroys the public trust about how these decisions get made and how government operates. So we
right.
think this
and then the quality of the work they do, you never know if it's going to be any good.
That's right. And there have been problems with some of the work that we've gotten from our government contractors. I think there's a huge computer system that's chronically been a failure, and there's some allegations that maybe that contract came about because of political contributions. So this way we just clarify and make it clear that these decisions are based on price and service and quality and not your political checkbook.
So the bills that you have talked about so far that have been introduced and that have numbers, House Bills 45, 46, and 47, are there corresponding Senate bills?
No. Generally speaking, we always like to have just one bill. Some groups will introduce parallel House and Senate bills, but we have a sort of an environmental ethic, and we don't like to produce more bills than we actually need. So they're just those three House bills.
And then if they pass the House, do they have to then go to the Senate?
They have to be passed by the Senate and then signed by the governor.
Okay.
And so when people go to our Action Center, it's sort of a one-stop shop where they can write both their state representative, their state senator, and the governor and lieutenant governor, as we're always optimists that these bills will make it to the governor, and we want the governor to be acquainted with what we're trying to accomplish.
Fred Nathan is the founder and executive director of Think New Mexico, which can be found on the web at thinknewmexico.org. And as again, there's an action center there where people can get involved. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Appreciate it.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program artist Michelle Blade. She is doing some events in Santa Fe this week on Thursday, the 17th of January. She will be at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, Tipton Hall, in conversation with art historian Kristan Vilela. It's called Conversation Living Through the End. And then she will be doing an exhibition that opens this Friday at the CCA in Santa Fe called Making Light of It. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Ah, thank you. So happy to be here.
It's great to have you. This exhibition is so interesting to me. You did last year in 2012 a new painting every day of the year. So there's 366 paintings, and they will all be exhibited in this show, and also some of your sculptures. And it's called 366 Days of the Apocalypse.
Yeah.
Tell us about that project, how you decided to do it, what went into it sort of conceptually and artistically.
Sure. It started, actually, I have to say, I had 2 days of preparation in 2011. I was kind of shifting into not a lot of new things in my life, and I thought of the idea and jumped right in. It seemed appropriate because 2012 is the, it was the year that the Mayans, well, I think a lot of people misinterpreted that it was the apocalypse. That,
yeah, right.
December 21st would be the end of the world,
and
really.
And here we are.
And here, well, here we are. It, you know, I think on second glance, and what I kind of thought about it as well is it's a cultural shift that was supposed to take place and is still continuing to take place since this marker. So I thought that would be a really interesting framework to create art under for an entire year. So it was an opportunity for me to dig into my practice, have a daily ritual of my own, to see improvements in my thought and my technique, just to become more dedicated to my practice. I do have a daytime job, so it was nice to have to just to dig in deep. So it was great.
The paintings, and I've only seen them online. I haven't seen them at CCA yet. I guess they're probably in the process of being installed right now. Are, to me, they're so beautiful, and it really makes me happy when an artist is really, really good at her craft. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the craft. You use a technique that looks like watercolor, but the colors are a lot more vivid.
Sure. It's actually acrylic-based calligraphy ink, and that's why it's more more chroma-filled. Watercolors usually dry. About 50% of the color kind of disappears once it dries. And this this kind of acrylic-based ink, it still acts like watercolors, where it's fluid and it's bleeding, and you have to be very very aware of what the actions are and ready to react to that. Sometimes it feels almost out of your control and you have to respond to what the paint is doing rather than you being the one in control. It's a very interesting relationship and one of the reasons why I choose to use it.
And you can't, I mean, you can't sort of work one area for a few hours. I mean, it's very, what you see is what you get, and if you screw it up, you have to start all over.
It's a pretty fast process, I would say. Probably the longest I spent on any of these paintings was maybe 3 hours. So it's, but I can also do a painting in half an hour. It just depends how loose and free you're going to be. But it's not like oil painting where you can come back to it and work back into the light areas. Or.
And so doing a painting every day, and they're all pretty much the same size, how did you decide what you were going to do each day? Were you inspired by the moment? Did you have kind of a series of paintings at different points throughout the year that you worked on?
Well, when I first started, I didn't know what to do. I felt very lost the first week. And it was an intense first week, I remember, because I felt like I was flailing. And I remember even in that moment thinking, oh God, maybe I'm not a good painter anymore. I don't know where to go with this. It was very interesting. And then it clicked into gear. And it's almost like keeping a journal. I mean, you have thoughts and inspirations that you come across every day. And when you're in the habit and in the practice of actually checking into that part of you, it becomes more, it's easier and easier as it goes on. So I found myself having a plethora of things that inspired me. You know, whether it was like a book I was reading that day, a line I had heard in a song, or a conversation I had with a friend. I started getting into the habit of, on my lunch breaks, going to the library. And even for, you know, at that hour that I had, it became a roulette game where I would go into, like, the anthropology section, and I'd pull out books and I would look at images, and things would happen, and I would learn new things, and I would feed it back into this project. And it was great.
And the paintings are so, to me, there's, each one is so poetic. It's like, I don't know your life. I don't know you. I don't know where they're coming from. But I think one of the things that's beautiful about it is that they speak to viewers that you don't know about our own sort of visual, conceptual senses, like whether it's an animal or a book or a burning house or a hand or a moon or whatever. They're kind of universal images that somehow resonate. I don't know. I can't explain exactly how that works, but They're very effective.
I think something that has to do with it that I've been looking at a lot in my practice is just, it's like an existential kind of longing to connect within these books that have different philosophies, you know, that I depict, or even like the Burning House series they're very symbolic of things that we've seen in literature and in films, you know, of like this passion and longing or horror, or, you know, they're things that we can instantly tap into because we've seen these images, and we're in a day and age where we're so saturated with imagery that I think I tried to link that and bring it into the conversation with the paintings that I was making. You know, they're linked to photography and they're kind of painted in a way sometimes where they reference that, and, you know,
now, how has this, I mean, now we're in mid-January, your 366 days are over, and you didn't miss a day.
No.
You did it every single day.
Yeah. Done.
For real. You
done.
Didn't do two on one day.
I'm done, yes.
But what are you doing now? Did it change the way you're doing your work?
Well, you know, since I ended, I'm now down here and I'm installing. I'm still finishing the final touches of the project. I'm not doing a daily painting anymore, but I'm, you know, I had to kind of create a huge way to organize these paintings. I'm still linked to it. However, I do feel incredibly free not to have to find that time in my day, and that I can be creative in other ways. I don't know. I feel lighter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Michelle Blade's exhibition, Making Light of It, will open this Friday, the 18th of January, from 6:30 to 8 at the CCA. And it's at the Munoz Waxman Gallery, which is that big building right next to the CCA. It's a wonderful, huge space.
Beautiful space.
Yeah. And it'll be open Friday through Sunday, 12 to 5, through the 17th of January. So it's up for a whole month. And then also Michelle will be talking to Cristan Villela, who is a pre-Columbian Mesoamerican art historian, on Thursday, the 17th of January, from 6 to 7:15, at Tipton Hall at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. And that's free and open to the public. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome back to the program Eric Herm. He is a farmer and author. His new book is called Surviving Ourselves, The Evolution of Community, Education, and Agriculture in the 21st Century. And he will be speaking at Collected Works on the 17th of January. That's this Thursday at 6 o'clock here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So you are talking about basically the many, many problems, social problems, environmental problems, food system problems that we have in this country and indeed in the world. And you have a really interesting perspective as a farmer from West Texas. What do you see as a farmer that the rest of us, perhaps living in cities or not doing that kind of work, that we aren't seeing?
Well, we need to get back to nature. I think that we've been trained for several generations now to take a lot of things for granted, and first and foremost, our food. But everything, from my perspective, stems from our relationship with nature and how we are essentially a part of everything, and nature is an extension of ourselves. And yeah, we've been trained to treat everything like a commodity or just make money or get caught up in the daily grind, and we don't really get down to the fundamentals of living. And by doing so, by focusing on our food, water, our shelter, our communities, our love for one another, I think that we can help solve a lot more of our problems instead of trying to wait for government or corporations to solve it for us.
One of the things that you are really working on is looking at the food system and the problems with the food system, genetically modified foods, herbicides, pesticides, and a way of farming that has certainly been done and is being done in the area where you live. You completely switched over to organic farming. How did you do that, and what was it like, and why did you do it?
Well, I felt that there was a need. I saw the commodities or the commercial agriculture aspect just continues to get more and more entrenched with the chemical companies and the GM, genetically modified crops. And even though I started doing that when I first moved back to the farm, I saw that we were in fact causing more problems with the huge dependence on chemicals. And the problems that GMOs present are so many layers and so complicated that, you know, we haven't even really seeing what that's going to do to us and the soil and everything around it long term, I just felt that there was a real need to get back to nature, to simplify things, to be have a more purified approach. And organics was the best way I knew how to do that. And it helps not only open up yourself and reconnect you to the earth and your surroundings, but it's a win-win because it's better for the environment, it's better for your long-term personal health, and it's better for everyone around. The way that I went about it is just basically hard work. I mean, you roll up your sleeves and put on your boots and you go about it. There's more work involved doing it this way than just going out there and planting and spraying Roundup on everything a couple times a year, which is what most guys around here do. You make a decision and you stay dedicated to it and you keep on with it and you don't give in. Even though we're probably one of the last family farms around here who are not doing the Roundup farming, I'm dedicated to it and I'm going to keep on doing it for as long as I can.
How do the farmers around you respond to what you're doing?
There's a lot of skepticism. Fortunately, I have some organic farmers and their experience to lean on. They're farther to the north of me, you know, about 40, 50 miles. But some of these guys have been doing it for 20 years. They're real, what I consider pioneers in the organic, modern organic industry. My neighbors around me, they think I'm crazy. They think that I probably lost my mind. And if you're farming in West Texas, you need to be a little crazy because that's what helps you get by on a lot of days. But, I don't know. I'm definitely in the minority, so I don't really worry too much about what others are thinking about me.
What is your vision for what farming in the U.S. could be like? I mean, it's a big step to go, I don't even know if it's back or forward, to a family farming model, but how do you see a healthy form of agriculture in this country?
Well, I think just the way you said it, you need to do a little do-si-do. You got to go backwards as you're going forward in this dance, and I think that we take some of the old-school methods, the healthy ones, the innovative concepts that worked, and we couple that with a little bit of modernization. And to me, by no means do we rely completely on technology. And for me personally, I by no means rely strictly on the old concepts. I try to blend everything together. And to me, what I would think we need to be doing to make everything work moving forward in this country is to localize, first and foremost, localize our food production in this country to secure our food and water supply in our communities. If we want to revolutionize the economy, localizing our food system, our food supply, and making sure that it's healthy and organic and getting away from GMOs and trying to push more legislation to get the labeling with GMOs. I know New Mexico is working on that as we speak. Proposition 37 failed in California, but there's other states moving forward. It takes everybody to be vigilant and what I consider to be a food revolution and is more or less really an existence revolution.
How do you see the relationship between your vision and the reality that so many people live in cities, and that's not really about to change?
Well, there's so many wonderful concepts and different ideas. I don't think there's any magic wand or bullet that's going to solve all this. To me, it's different beats for different feet, and what works best for me here in West Texas is going to be different for works for people in Santa Fe or Albuquerque or New York City. You got a lot of urban farms that are popping up, a lot of CSAs, you know, the concepts of vertical gardens, of buildings that are green friendly, that have more windows open to the south that you can grow small gardens in them. There's a number of concepts, and we're going to have to implement all of them. Permaculture, I think, is a wonderful, wonderful tool for us, and you got Scott Pittman there with the Permaculture Institute right there in Santa Fe. We're going to have to implement some more concepts that are less labor-intensive and more more friendly for our own personal climate.
One thing that's so interesting about your book is that you kind of paint a picture of groups all over the world, whether they be indigenous groups or organic farmers, who are all kind of looking toward a similar vision of an earth-friendly future. And I have to say, in a world where it's not easy to be optimistic given the reality that we have, the fact of all these people who are working simultaneously, if not exactly together, is very interesting and kind of gives me a sense of hope.
Yeah, that's what I feel like this book will do and can do for people, because it gives you real-life examples of people who are out there doing this, and they're changing the world for the better, and they're making this work. And often I think it's easy for us to just throw our hands up in the air and say, well, what can I do? Well, you've got some key examples of just a few people in this book that are doing whatever it takes to make this world a better place, and to really be innovative, be creative, and also be efficient economically and in every other concept, whether it's the business model or their own personal lives or in the communities such as the town of Saxapaw, North Carolina. And that's what I really wanted to get across to people, is like there is hope, there is a chance for us to right this ship and really start steering it in a different direction, and that's what we all need to be doing if we're not already.
One of the things that you talk about in the book is just simple things that everybody can do, which is essentially putting your feet on the ground and sitting quietly and watching the sunrise, and things that are so simple that you, in a way, you think you shouldn't even have to write them down. But one of the examples that you give is they did this study of, they sent one group of people for a walk in a shopping mall and the other group of people for a walk in nature. And the results of how those two different groups felt afterwards was really striking.
Yeah, and I everybody's wired a little bit differently. For me personally, I don't function that well in crowded areas, particularly, if I go to Walmart on the weekends or anywhere where there's crowds and lots of concrete and asphalt, I start to, look for an exit real quick. And I think that that's really how we are, a lot of us are, deep inside, even though if you're an urban dweller or not, I think that most of us long for that connection to nature, and we need it. We have to have it in our lives. And, even if you can only spend 5-15 minutes a day, just, whether it's a walk in the park or just having your moment in early in the mornings or late in the evenings, just make sure you dedicate that time each day. And that way helps ground us a little bit more, instead of trying to go to doctors who will prescribe us more meds to get over our depressions or anxieties.
One thing that I've been noticing recently that is incredibly easy and also easy to overlook living here in a city is you just watch the birds that are outside, and they're amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible how many different creatures that we don't even notice or pay much attention to, but when you start to dedicate that time, it's amazing what you learn, not only about that particular animal or creature, but also what you'll learn about yourselves and that connection that exists and everything.
Eric Herm is a farmer and a writer. His new book is called Surviving Ourselves, The Evolution of Community, Education, and Agriculture in the 21st Century. And once again, he'll be at Collected Works Bookstore on Thursday, the 17th at 6 o'clock, right here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, collectedworksbookstore.com. And on Friday, January 18th at noon, Eric will also be speaking at the Natural Grocers by the Vitamin Cottage at 3328 Cerrillos Road here in Santa Fe. Eric Herm, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
All right, thanks for having me.
And Eric Herm's website is sonofafarmer.com.